Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
All right, on today's episode of Nothing Major, we're going to talk a little bit of Super Bowl. We're going to talk what happened in Dallas and Rotterdam. We're also going to talk about tournaments this week, including Delray Beach, where myself and Steve Johnson actually played in the event. Stevie maybe didn't have his greatest showing against Tommy Haas. And then we are going to elaborate our hot guy field, doing a 16-man draw. And then finally, we have an awesome interview with Tommy Paul. We recorded this before Australia. We're going to have it here for you guys today. Everyone loves Tommy. He's one of our favorite players. He's going to talk about partying when he was a teen. He almost had John Isner coach him for a tournament at one point. We're going to dive into all of that. So with that, let's get into today's episode. Everyone, welcome back to Nothing Major, joined by John Isner, Steve Johnson, Charlie Fox, a team at SIF Creative. No Jack Sock today. His beloved Chiefs were in the Super Bowl. We all know he's a massive Chiefs fan. And so he was watching the game on Sunday on a flight right now. So we're missing him, but he better listen to the episode, I guess, when it comes out. I'm sure you guys watched the Super Bowl. Thoughts? Who are you guys cheering for? John, did you want the Chiefs or did you want the Eagles?
No, Eagles.
I feel like everyone kind of wanted the Eagles.
It was crazy. You never thought that Philadelphia could have been America's team, but I feel like most of the country was rooting for the Eagles.
I didn't really care one way or the other, but I think most of the people wanted the Eagles because I guess people don't really, unless you're from that area, like, you know, Jack or somebody or the Patriots back in the day, the dynasty maybe gets old for the mass majority. They want to see a new winner or a new kind of like comeback story or whatever it is. So I think most of the people, it seemed like cruising around, I was in Florida last week, were heavy Eagles, a lot more green than red for sure.
It was a bad game. It reminded me of, it was kind of the equivalent of, what was that year that Nadal beat Federer at the French Open, 6-3, 6-1, 6-0? This game was over at halftime. It felt like that.
Yeah, but I think the difference is that match, obviously, crazy amount of hype going into it, bit of a dud. I didn't feel like there was that much hype going into this game. I think America definitely wanted to see, prior to the Super Bowl, like, I think the ideal matchup was Detroit versus Buffalo.
Yeah.
You know, two teams hadn't gotten it done in such a long time. But then this was a rematch from a couple years ago, so it wasn't that much hype, and the game was a bit of a dud. So all in all, not a great Super Bowl.
All right, enough Super Bowl. Let's talk about last week. We had Dallas and Rotterdam, two massive 500s. Isner, you're the mayor of Dallas. You're also kind of the mayor of the Dallas tournament. I saw you on I was actually broadcasting a lot of it. Camera constantly going over to you. The people just wanted to see you watching tennis for some reason.
Exactly.
It was just a real treat for everyone involved. How was the event? I mean, I know you were there pretty much every day. Big final for Denis Shapovalov over Casper Ruud. Is Shapo kind of back in the mix as a top player? And give us just your overall thoughts of the event.
The event was a huge success in year one up in Frisco. Couldn't ask for anything better. I mean, the energy yesterday before the final, like, I'm driving in, it was a 1 o'clock Dallas time final. I'm kind of driving in, about to park my car at like 12:15. And there's all sorts of people already walking, filing in to the arena. You get there and there was a lot of people sitting in their seats. You could sort of feel the buzz even at 12:30, 30 minutes before the final. So I just knew right then and there that was a good sign for the match, you know, coming up at 1 o'clock. But the night sessions were fantastic. Crowds were awesome. Yesterday, complete sellout. Saturday, complete sellout, both sessions. Really well done tournament. I mean, partnering with the Dallas Cowboys, like, pretty lucky. For the Dallas Open, you get a brand like that. Probably the biggest, not probably, it is the biggest sports brand in the world to partner up with you.
Maybe not the world, maybe America. They're not bigger than like Real Madrid, are they?
What are you talking about, dude? They're the highest. Stevie,
I'm with John.
They're the number one most valuable franchise in the world, Sam.
Yeah, I'm with John.
I know they're up there. They are. Feel like one of those soccer franchises.
No, they're not up there. No, that's not up for debate. They're not up there. They're number one.
Value is just the value. Until someone buys it, that's the value.
I think you're both right. John is correct. The value is like the most expensive team for sure. But worldwide, there's going to be a soccer team that's way more influential.
Not in my mind.
Yeah, you live in Dallas and you're from there.
Every sports franchise in the world goes for sale right now. Which one is bought for the most amount of money? Cowboys?
It's the Dallas Cowboys.
It's the Cowboys.
By a large margin.
Monetarily, they're the most expensive for sure, but recognizable. I'm going to say Barcelona or one of those like soccer teams.
I think Manchester United is number two. So you're up. You're right, Stevie.
I'm saying monetarily, the Cowboys are the biggest, most expensive franchise sporting anywhere. No doubt.
They're Roger Federer.
All right. And Manchester United's Rafa.
Back to my original point. When you get to partner with the most valuable franchise in the world, the biggest brand in the world, sports brand, standing by that. All in all, it made for a great tournament. Now, digging into the actual tournament, Shapovalov was incredible. And you sort of got the sense, once he beat Taylor Fritz in the second round, 7-6 in the third, he was about to take off. He gained all sorts of confidence from that point forward. He beat Mahach, 7-6, 6-love in the quarters. Then he takes out Tommy Paul in straight sets and then Casper Ruud in straight sets. Three top 10 wins en route to his biggest title of his career, the number one, the number two, and the number three seed were all vanquished by Shapovalov. So you asked the question, Sam, is Shapo back? And me watching him, the answer is absolutely yes. I mean, he was swashbuckling out there, ripping winners from the back of the court, not double faulting that much. One-handed backhand was on fire, especially down the line passes. He was incredible. One was definitely playing top 10 tennis this week. I would say he's playing top five tennis. What I saw yesterday in the semifinals against Tommy, again, after he beat Taylor in the second round, his confidence went a long, long way to take him to the title.
Who was the crowd cheering for? We had Shapo versus Casper Ruud in the final, Canadian versus the Norwegian. We got a Dallas crowd. Was it like a 50-50 or was the crowd one way or the other?
It was like 80-20 for Casper.
80-20 Casper. That's what I couldn't tell watching. I was curious.
So obviously Casper was the big name European for the tournament, and they started to really like him, and the crowd got into the Ruud. They kept saying. So it sounded like obviously he was getting booed, but the crowd and the Dallas faithful really, really liked that. So yeah, they were for Casper for sure. They wanted him to try to come back. First set was great tennis, and Bashapo was too good at the end.
Rotterdam. Also going on that week, Carlos Alcaraz with the title. I feel stupid saying this. He kind of had an easy draw, but like, not that he needs help. He's going to beat everyone anyway. But Stevie, did Carlos need to win this tournament to like keep pace with Sinner? The end of his year last year, so-so, beginning of this year, quartered Australia, hasn't won a tournament. You feel like this was almost like a must-have win for Alcaraz standards?
Yeah, I mean, these are the types of tournaments that for the longest, pretty much, I guess, maybe the entirety of my life, you always just expected Roger, Rafa, Novak, Murray. If they were the one seed and nobody else was in the draw, they just took care of business and they won it. And this was big for Carlos. He was there. Losing to Novak in the quarters of Australia is not what he wanted to do. So it's good for him to get off the mat a little bit, get a win, kind of kickstart his year. Because I think for him, it's just important to get to the end of the tournament and win. I mean, he's got an incredible record in finals, and he was in some troubles in the semis for playing Hurkacz. He was down 1-4 serving love 40, and ultimately came back and won that set 6-4. So he was in some trouble in the semis. Hubie kind of took the foot off the gas and kind of let him slip away with that first set, and Carlos got rolling after that point. But Carlos he's an animal. His top end tennis is arguably the best in the world. I just think the everyday level sometimes fluctuates a little bit too much, but not this week. He was able to get it done. So hopefully it was a good choice for him to stay in Europe and, win an indoor tournament. He's good on every surface. He can title on whatever. I mean, he chose not to go to Rio this year and stayed in Rotterdam close to home and got there early and got a title. And that was massive for him. Just proving that he can win on every surface. Doesn't matter the day, time of year, you name it.
Look, we know he can win on every surface because he's won on hard court, clay court, grass court. This is his first indoor hard court title. Sometimes I feel like we put too much emphasis on indoor hard court versus outdoor hard court. A hard court's a hard court. Do you think, I'm going to go over to John, do you think his indoor hard court level is, like, where does it stack up compared to how he plays on other surfaces at this moment?
Yeah, it's a good question. By the way, can we talk about how, like, even if you go on, like, the ATP's website, they still call it, like, carpet?
It's ridiculous. It hasn't been on carpet in 30 years.
What is that? I know. And it's like, is that indoor hard? I think their carpet means it's like, get rid of that. ATP, yeah. Tennis in general. Yeah. No, I think, look, the sample size for indoor tennis for most players is typically pretty small because obviously we sort of chase the sun all year round. So there really aren't that many indoor tournaments that Carlos is going to play in general. Obviously, he'll play, you know, Paris at the end of the year, maybe a Vienna or Basel, you know, and then now he played this one in Rotterdam in February. So he hasn't played as many indoor matches, his first indoor title. I look, he's surface agnostic. He can play on anything, right? It doesn't really matter. So, I mean, I think it's certainly big for his confidence. As Stevie said, beating Hurkacz in the semifinals, a big server on indoor courts, that's a big win for Carlos. So, you know, great decision by him staying close to home and picking up a big title.
Yeah, I mean, not to like elaborate on this, you know, but is there anybody better than beating people ranked below them consistently and badly as Demonauer right now? The guy does not lose to people below him, and he just takes care of business. And ultimately, he's kind of got to get over the hump of getting over the guys ranked ahead of him. But the guy is an animal. It's just going out there, taking care of business, and just closing the door on anyone ranked below him. It's just every week. It's just consistent.
He's such a tough out. Anyway, big week last week, too, for no-strip guys, Alcaraz and Casper Ruud. We saw the everyone's breathing well at these tournaments. All right, moving on to this week. We've got Marseille. We don't even need to talk about that. Buenos Aires. We got our buddy Diego Schwartzman. Last event. John, you weren't there when we had him on the pod. You guys played doubles in Rome one year. Has that been your favorite partner you've ever played with on the doubles court?
I think the story of this week throughout all three tournaments is without a doubt Diego playing his last tournament on home soil in his hometown. But yeah, I think probably that was the most fun I've ever had on a tennis court. It kind of started out as like a bit of a joke because we talked years about playing doubles together. Then it finally came together in Rome and with zero strategy, zero. We went out, zero. Like, you know how we all do it. We don't talk about doubles. We went out there and like we somehow, like I think we won our first match in like a third set tiebreaker or something. And then we won our second match. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Now we're in the quarters or whatever it is. Like, let's try to keep going. And then we got all the way to the finals with match point, with Diego returning a second serve. And like I thought, oh, this is it. He's just going to crack a return winner. And he actually did crack a return. And then it was one of those the chair umpire had to get out of his chair and check the mark. It was that close. Anyways, I had a blast playing with Diego. That was so much fun. The people in Rome loved the juxtaposition of me and Diego. It was Mutt and Jeff out there. It was a good time.
It's fun to watch. And Delray Beach this week. The big story in Delray was probably – myself and Xavier Malisse lost to the Bryan brothers in an exciting Legends doubles match. And then the following day, our very own Steve Johnson played Tommy Haas and just got absolutely shellacked 6-1, 6-3 in the Legends event at Delray Beach singles. That news probably didn't reach the masses. So luckily now on the show, people know about it. Stevie, how was your level against Tommy Haas? The scoreline would indicate that you were terrible, but we all know Tommy practices a bunch. He's pretty good for a guy in his mid-40s.
You actually gave me a little too much credit. The scoreline was 6-3, 6-1, only because the level in my second set went from like here to like just off of a cliff immediately. I could not move anymore. I was so tired. I got down 4-love in the second set. I'm just like, please, please get a game. Don't get bageled out here in an exhibition. Like that would be a tough look. I'll tell you what, my body feels horrible. My hips, my glutes, everything is sore.
Really?
Oh, dude, my abs, like everything is sore.
3-1, that couldn't have taken more than like 40 minutes.
No, it took about 43, very sore, but
43.
Yeah, 43. It was good though. Had a lot of fun. It was fun to be in Delray. I feel like I let the people down though. Walking around the locker room, everyone expected me to win the pickle match, Sam. Nobody had faith in you on tour, and I had to tell them pretty much outright that I was terrible, and it was all false bravado, basically.
Sam, what if I could touch on that? You said people were asking you in Delray, in Dallas, like if I was walking around.
It was the talk of the tournament.
I was curious to see how much traction the pickleball match was going to pick up on our pod, and it picked up a lot, and I had a lot of people, especially like younger kids, like, you know, junior tennis players, maybe in college tennis players, come up to me asking me who won the match. It was, I can't tell you how many people, 10 to 15 people came up and stopped me and asked me about the big pickle match.
It's still on YouTube. It is fantastic. It's a good watch. Moving on with a little feedback from the match. We hinted on it earlier, Stevie Johnson and myself, as we know, I came out with the big W. We read all the suggestions on YouTube of players that want the three of us to kind of have Stevie DM, guy, people who you want on the podcast. Number one is Medvedev.
I'm excited.
I've actually already reached out to Medvedev. I got nothing. I don't even think he read the comments. So Stevie, you're going to have to do a little more digging, try to get a hold of his phone number or something, but Medvedev is number one on the list of five that you are going to have to DM.
All right.
People also wanted Nadal, Federer. So do we. That's going to be tough. Seal. A few people wanted Seal on there. A big tennis fan. Murray, Roddick, Brad Gilbert, Michael Costa. I think John knows Michael Costa maybe a little bit. So yeah. I think we can get Michael Costa. Monfils on there. John, is there anyone that you specifically want Stevie to reach out to?
No, I'm going to let the fans decide. I'm just curious to see how many responses he's going to get.
The over-under is at 0.5.
Yeah, I think Costa would get back to you.
I think so. We're going to come out with that list of five this week, and we'll let the fans know. Finally, last week, we did a hot guy segment. Hottest guys on tour. Everyone loved it. The fans felt like we left out Dimitrov, Rude, Arthur Fies, maybe snubbed. We were just kind of going off the cuff a little bit, so no disrespect to those guys. But we're going to compile a list of the 16 hottest guys on tour, maybe 15 hottest guys, one wild card. We're not sure who that wild card is going to be yet. And we're going to make a 16-man draw. And we're going to let the fans vote on that draw, you know, first round, second round, all the way through. We're going to get a winner. And we're going to come up with the hottest guy on the ATP tour. And then ultimately, we're going to try to give that player we're getting a little trophy made, maybe give it to him at Indian Wells. But this is going to be voted on by the fans. We're going to pick the players, and then the fans are going to pick who is hottest. And we're going to see that how that goes. I think, you know, top seeds off the top of my head, we got Dimitrov, Tommy Paul, Berrettini, Casper Ruud. Those feel like maybe the seeds 1 through 4. But we're going to have 16 hotties on there for everyone to vote on.
Dude, it's going to be fun. Seriously, would you say that, man? I'm sorry.
I mean, John, I don't know about you, but I feel as if we should – I really want to send out the screenshot of Sam sending his list of top 16. The spelling, we have to get to the bottom of this. It's atrocious.
Well, I will defend Sam. He was, you know, writing the list quickly, so it wasn't, you know, and the spell check might have gotten a few wrong.
It's like American autocorrect too. It doesn't know Berrettini.
He can't even get Grigor's name right.
What are you talking about?
You spell it Gregor, and that is not how it's spelled.
Gregor.
I don't spell it like that. That's autocorrect.
No, dude, come on.
All right, I mean, I maybe not be the best speller, admittedly, but come on,
Matteo Berrettini.
Okay, I know it's Berrettini.
You got JJ's name wrong.
You got JJ's name wrong, dude. Like, come on.
You guys didn't even put out lists. You didn't even put out a list. You can't rip my list when you give no list.
Dude, the hottie guy list was your brainchild, apparently, now, after last week's segment. So we're going to let you run with it.
I'm just saying, it was like the people love the segment. Why not keep going and see who the ultimate hottie is?
I'm with you, but
dude, don't say that word anymore.
Who's your early pick? Who you got with you? Let's all give a pick. Who we think is going to win it?
I think Tommy, because probably most of our followers are American. So, I mean, it depends on how much of the European vote we get.
I'm going to say Draper.
Whoa, that's an upset.
He's smooth.
I'm going to go with Ben Shelton. I think Shelton's winning it.
So not Matteo Berrettini.
Not Barotti.
Not Mateo Barotti.
All right. We'll look forward to that. Check our social channels. We're going to let you, the fans, vote on who you think is the hottest ATP player in tennis right now. Okay, time to get into our Tommy Paul interview. It was recorded a while ago. It's an awesome interview. Jack was here for that interview. So with that, let's talk to Tommy. Okay, everyone, we've got Tommy Paul on the podcast today. Career high number 12. You got four titles, Stockholm, Dallas, Queens, and another Stockholm. You have two Stockholms. Good job. I want to start with this. Your good buddy Taylor Fritz, finaled the U.S. Open. Shot him a text. He came on the podcast 5 days later, 6 days later at night. We've been grinding to get you for 2 months. You ghosted Stevie.
Wow. Put me on the spot.
Back and
right
forth. Like, what's like, why was it so difficult to get
you? I had to go see him in person in Florida.
Yeah, why is it so difficult to get you on here? You that busy?
Wait. Did Stevie say I ghosted him?
Yeah, he showed us the text receipt too.
Bud.
We got the receipts.
I mean, you got me there.
No, I don't know. Like, you know, it kind of just gets pushed back every time you text me. And I mean, I'm on now, right? Like,
no, we finally got you. It's tough to get people. I don't know if you saw. I've been DMing everyone. I DM Matthew McConaughey, who tweeted it.
I'm surprised he hasn't been on yet.
Wait. He DM'd you. Maybe I go through you to get to McConaughey.
Yeah, I mean, he'll probably unfollow me at that point.
Probably. All right. No more McConaughey. All right. We'll move on.
All right, Tommy. We're going to get a little bit more serious here. We're going to talk about your junior days to professional tennis. We have something in common, kind of. I went to the University of Georgia. You committed to the University of Georgia. I think that's not such a well-known fact. You committed there. I think you made the right choice not going to Georgia. So if I can ask you, would you be playing professional tennis right now if you went to school in Athens, Georgia for 4 years?
For 4 years, probably not. But I think if I were to do it again, I would have gone to school.
Okay.
I think I partied just as hard my first 2 years as a pro as if I would have went to school. So I don't think there was too much of a difference there. I would have just had to do schoolwork. That's the only difference, I think.
So would you say that was one of the reasons, maybe the main reason, you struggled so much from high school when you turned pro? Is this too much partying? Was it a lack of focus? Were those two kind of, those two things go hand in hand?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, that's part of it. I think I kind of lacked structure in a way. And then also for me, the USTA system was... I mean, it was great for me in the juniors. And then when I turned pro, kind of moving out of the USTA and kind of hiring my own coach and hiring my own team, it made me not want to waste any practices, made me not want to waste any time. And, I started training a lot harder. I started doing the right things a lot more, probably stopped going out as much. But, I think it was a bunch of things altogether, you know?
Kind of going back to those junior days, I think you guys were in Boca at the time at the USTA with Riley Opelka, Taylor Fritz. You know, the three of you guys have, you know, pretty well documented. You guys are all really close, you know, pushing each other kind of each and every, you know, step of the way here. And, you know, to have all you guys be top 20 players, obviously Riley's hurt right now and hopefully we'll get back there. Does that friendship, does that bond help you guys push one another? Do you find, you know, that you're competitive with one another, or is it just kind of pushing your friends to bigger and better things?
I think it helps a ton. I mean, obviously we grew up, I mean, we've played each other at every level. You know, I played Francis when I was 10, and he was 11 at Nike Junior Tour. We played at every level of juniors and every level of pro tennis. So when you see them doing really well, you're happy for them, but you want to move up with them. And of course we're super competitive. And I think that, I mean, you have to be competitive to do what we do. You guys know. So, I mean, I think we drive each other.
Yeah. I mean, kind of on that same topic, like obviously Fritz kind of broke in the top 100, early on, young age. Francis, same. Was it hard, like, for you, like, you guys being close to see them, I guess, with the success and then maybe you coming in a little later, or how was that?
Yeah. I mean, I was kind of like the last one. Last one to make it. Fritz kind of jumped in real quick. I mean, right after juniors. I mean, I think he finished he had the best junior career out of us. I think he was the only one that got to number one in the world. And I mean, right out of juniors, he won like four challengers in a row and then finaled Memphis. And he kind of jumped on there really quick. And I don't think any of us felt like jealousy in any sort of way. We were all just like happy for him, and it motivated all of us to do better. Some people and motivated more and got there faster, but you know, I'm happy that I'm there now. And you know, I think we have a sick group of guys. I mean, all very different personalities, you know. I mean, every single one of us are so different in so many ways, but we're still such close friends. I think that's really cool.
That is cool. You guys literally have, like, if you asked all four of you, like, what are your hobbies? It's four completely different things, like you're saying. Like, completely different.
Completely different people. And then you go to, like, Riley, and Riley's like, you know, we all know Riley. Like, you never know what he's doing.
If you go back to when you, Riley Opelka, Francis Tiafoe, and Taylor Fritz are all, like, 14, 15 years old, who was the best player then?
Fritz was the worst.
Yeah.
By a lot.
Which is crazy because, like, he's had the best career over the last
100%. 4 years. Like, yeah, I mean, he's the best out of us, you know? And Fritz, me, Riley, we were all 97s, and then Francis was 98, but he was... And you know how, like, years now, they don't make a difference, but when you're 14 to 13 or 13 to 15, it makes a huge difference. And I think Francis was probably better than us, a year younger than us. So he was kind of like, he was the guy, you know, everyone knew how much talent he had. His strokes were all busted and he was still busting our asses.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I can see that. Fritz is like that guy too. I love the, you can kind of make fun of him for like certain like shots or movement. He'll like push back, be like, no, like I am the best mover on tour and yeah. I have the best
work. Yeah, absolutely. No, he tells us he's the hardest working American. And we're like, what? Like, how, dude? How? But no, I mean, I remember the first time Fritz came to USTA, he had never played on clay court, I'm pretty sure. And he came and he started doing fitness with us and they put him on the treadmill going like 7. On the treadmill, and he tripped over his own feet and was like hanging on, dragging his legs on the treadmill, and we were like, what is this guy doing?
Was he always sort of like nutty in the sense that he would like play through pain and just compete like hell? Because, you know, he had that story where he tore his meniscus at the French Open, and then he came back and played Wimbledon, like
beat me
3.5, beat Stevie at Wimby. Stevie in his prime too. Oh, whatever. It was a good win. Stevie on grass is a good win. Like, was Taylor always sort of like that, a little crazy in a good way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a secret weapon of his. He doesn't look like the toughest guy ever, but I mean, he plays through everything, and we all know the kind of schedule that he plays. You're definitely not feeling good for most of that schedule if you're playing all of those events. So, I mean, he's tough. I mean, I like to think that he's one of the best competitors on tour right now. Like, I don't think that's an exaggeration at all. Yeah, I mean, he's a tough kid.
Yeah, a little bit more about your career, Tommy. Kind of coming up through the ranks, you know, obviously being a top 5 junior in the world, there's a lot of hype around you. There's not a lot of success early in your career. And then sometimes getting stuck in challengers is a tricky spot to be in, futures challengers before you get to the big leagues on the tour. Was that struggle, was that time period more mental? Was it more emotional, more tennis? Like, what were your kind of feelings in those moments, you know, watching Taylor break into the top 100 and you still kind of being at a level below him?
In terms of like what held me back or like how I felt about everyone doing well?
Yeah, what do you think held you back a little bit? Was it just like growth, maturity, tennis, on court, off court?
Yeah, I wasn't mature enough. Straight up, I don't think I was mature enough. I wasn't going to these tournaments to win. Like, I knew at a young age, like, I was really good, but I didn't quite know what it took to go into these tournaments. You can't go into these tournaments without confidence and beat these good players. Maybe you win one match, but it's about stringing matches together. It's about going in there and taking care of your body through a whole week. And I mean, I think that's like the main thing that changed was, I mean, I'm going in there and I'm not like around, you know, I'm going in there to win.
absolutely. For talking about age range between like 18 and 20, like you used to party a little bit. We all used to party a little bit. Sometimes I feel like people, you get like not a bad rep, but like, oh, Tom used to party. Like we all used to go out a bunch too. Maybe not as much as you, but we did go out. Were you going out, like, you know, when you were younger, like, did you like to go out just because, like, it was fun and going out? Or was part of it, like, you felt a little pressure? You maybe saw, like, Fritz and Francis jump into the top 100, and you're just like, oh, I'm going to cope with it a little bit and by going out?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think so.
That's a deep question I just asked.
It's a deep question.
No, that was, I mean, yeah.
This is not the podcast for that.
No, it's a good question, though. I think – I don't really think so because, I mean, I like partying when we were young, you know, before they were even, like, better than me in a way, you know. So I think it just kind of went on too long. It took too long for me to get out of that stage.
Yeah, I think we have a pretty infamous story here that can be talked about or not talked about depending on – how you feel about it, but
I think we got to talk about it.
It involves a couple of us, nothing major cast members here.
An elephant in the room here, or what?
Yeah, I think.
No, but I think we got to talk about it. But I think we got to do it like right before the open. You know, get everyone fired up.
Oh, so that means you got to come back on the pod.
So don't ghost me. You know, next August.
Dude, I'm coming back.
We need to start planning 9 months ahead. Okay.
No, we'll send you a calendar invite for the Friday before the open. Yeah. once we're done.
A Riverside invite. Was there like a moment or was there like a something that clicked in your head where you're like, I gotta like tighten things up and like start getting more serious about it or what?
Yeah, there was definitely a moment. I think it was definitely.
It was 18.
Yeah, 18.
18.
Yeah,
but I mean, that came with some consequences. I mean, I had to do like, you know, community service and do all this bull. I was getting.
What was the community service? Like cleaning up stuff on the side of the freeways, or like
it was whatever you wanted it to be. You just had to do like you had to volunteer, like for something. And I mean, I didn't really
so what'd
get
you do?
All my hours, but I tried.
Where at? Like back at home?
In Orlando. It was from the USTA because I was still going there.
Yep.
And they had quite a few things I had to do. And I don't know. I think I was getting alcohol tested. So it was definitely before I was 21. 2018 probably. And I was getting alcohol tested, and then like I hired my own team. And I mean, like I said earlier, it was kind of just I didn't want to waste any time on the court, and I had kind of that was kind of my rock bottom, 2018. And I mean, I was kind of just putting all like everything into one basket and going all in. And if it failed, it failed. I mean, I think in 2018, I like was about to start taking online college classes. Like I didn't really even think I was gonna make it anymore. And I went to a future in Winston-Salem and lost first round to the guy who was playing number two in Minnesota. And I was like, you know, I think this career might not be for me. And then like I didn't play at all that week. There was another tournament the next week, and I called Diego, who was my coach. He's at Wimbledon with Riley. And he was like, oh, like just stay at the tournament, don't practice, and show up for the tournament next week. And I played, I either won it or lost in finals, and then quartered in D.C., or quartered Atlanta, quartered D.C., and then the incident at the U.S. Open. And then I was like, all right, like, that was rock bottom year for me. I have to turn things around.
So I didn't realize that was the same summer that, like, that Winston-Salem future happened, because I thought you were already, like, pretty close to the top 100, because you were doing well in those big ATP events, and you grinded me down for that shot at the Open, and we took it, baby.
No. Because the couple weeks before the U.S. Open, I racked up some points. Like, I quartered a couple tour events. I think Jack, you, like, final EC that year that I played, or the year that I made quarters. And,
yeah.
So I racked up some points, but earlier in that summer, I think I was definitely outside 250 because Riley was at Wimbledon and I was playing a 15K in Winston-Salem. So definitely wasn't close to top 100.
So right now you're 12 in the world. What do you think the difference is between like a top 20 guy and a top 10 guy? What do you have to do to make that next tiny little jump to get into the top 10?
You know, I was going to ask you that question. How many matches did you
don't
have
ask me. I got to I got to 11.
But you had a lot of matches.
I got to 11. I believe I had two chances to get in the top 10.
Oh, I thought it was more than that. What happened in those matches?
I think you lost Arione.
I guess it'd be more than that because, yeah, I guess when I was ranked like 15, if I would have like won Paris, I would have gotten the top 10. But I can only remember one. I remember playing Milos Raonic in Indian Wells when I was ranked 11. I lost in three sets.
Tough.
I didn't feel any like pressure to do anything though. I just lost. I just lost. Yeah. You don't want advice from me because like I'm not gonna lead you to the top 10. I get it from someone else.
It lead you to 11.
That knows how to get there. It'll lead you to 11, which is kind of cool.
Well, I guess two of y'all can help me with that.
Yeah. I think you ought to hire me, Tommy, as your coach. I can help you.
We were gonna do Cava, right?
Yes, we were. We were going. We had a partnership.
Yeah.
I was going to coach him in Cabo. Pro bono. Yes.
Yep.
Pro and then bono. He decided not to play.
Last summer.
This last summer.
Something. They changed the date. Remember?
Yes. True. Yeah. We were going to have all things set up, and I was going to be on the bag.
Oh yeah, I was going to say, Brad, stay in Fresno. I got the OG bot with me.
Exactly. I was going to, you know, work on your movement and your return and serve game. I think I was going to take you to another level, dude.
Did you reach out to John or did John reach out to you?
What did you see in John as a coach that you could have?
So here's the story. Cabo was my second to last tournament ever, and Tommy was playing it when I was there. And so like, I think I told him, I'm like, I'm done. I'm retiring at the US Open. I'm like, but next year, come back in Cabo, I'll be your coach. And he's like, done, deal. But then they changed it to February. You're exactly right. And you were booked.
But I think you only wanted to go because you had a nice setup.
I had a nice setup. Yeah, absolutely. That's why I wanted to coach you pro bono, for sure, to go down there.
Yeah, Tommy, is there somebody, you know, that you could kind of pinpoint in your career that really helped you kind of get out of that funk, you know, back in 2018? Was it a coach, you know, a mentor, somebody that you can kind of really like pinpoint, this is the person that really helped me or helped me change my outlook or outview of tennis to the person you are today?
I think Brad. I mean, I think that's an easy answer. I mean, he's done a lot for me. He was like the best hire I've ever made, and we all know him really well. I mean, the guy can talk, but he's a good coach, and you know, he got me out of a pretty good hole. But I mean, it's not just him. Like, I had a bunch of really good people around me. I mean, I was lucky to have the people around me who I did, like the team that I have right now. I mean, my trainer Franco, my physio, Seba, like they've all been with me for years now. I mean, I don't think just one person can get you out of a hole. I think it takes everything. Your whole team is so important, especially with the amount that we travel and the amount we're on the road. You guys know how it is. I mean, it's lonely on the road, you know, and especially when you're playing like shit, you don't want to be there anymore. You want to go home. And, you know, having the people around you to keep you motivated in times like that is huge.
Definitely. I think John and I were very much in that camp of when the lights were off and we were crispy, it was over.
Crispy. You're not crispy.
Someone called it out.
John always said that and it was a lie. You guys don't know what it's like in my brain. It's crispy.
Dude,
out there.
I think you might come back 2025.
I mean, you did start coaching 2 weeks after you retired, so.
He wanted to be back on the road.
Couldn't wait, dude. Couldn't wait. No, tennis is done for me. I played. We played some exhibition stuff, and it's over. I can barely run, you know, down the hall, let alone for more than, you know, a game or two. So, yeah, the comeback's dead.
You have a pretty impressive stat here. You have wins over everyone in the top eight except for Djokovic. I don't think any of us can say that, definitely. If you had to rank the top eight, which I could help. We got Sinner, Zverev, Alcaraz, Fritzy, Medvedev, Rude, Djokovic, Rublev.
Rank them in what?
From favorite to least favorite to play against.
Oh, like hardest or most?
Yeah, do you like feel better about some of them? Difficulty level.
Difficulty. I mean, Djokovic, besides Djokovic or Djokovic in there?
He's in there.
He's in there.
I mean, he's got to be number one most difficult. I mean, he made me feel stupid at Australian Open the time that I played him. And I was playing, obviously, my best tennis. And yeah, he made me feel dumb. So him, I haven't played Zverev in a really long time, but I mean, this year he obviously played some awesome tennis. Fritz probably wouldn't think so because Fritz was kind of his daddy this year. Alcaraz at Wimbledon this year, played at a level that was pretty wild when I played him. So I'm gonna put him at 2, Sinner 3. Sinner plays crazy fast as well. Fritz 4.
Here, you don't have to rank the last four. Just give us one. Yeah. Who would you want to play right now in a slam final?
Wait, who's in the group though?
So like Rublev, Casper, Medvedev. We didn't speak about
either Rublev or Medvedev.
All right. Speaking of slam finals, you probably listened to our episode like 10 weeks ago. We're talking about if any of us actually had the belief to win a slam. Isner and I both said at one point we did. I believe Jack and Stevie said at no point that they actually believe they can win a slam. Have you ever been in a slam draw and actually believed you could win it?
Yeah.
Actually.
I think so. Ooh. I think.
Which one?
I think Wimbledon last year or this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
I think, I played Alcaraz. I mean, I had beaten him a couple times. I didn't realize the level that he plays on grass. Obviously, he had won Wimbledon the year before, but I liked my level on the grass going in. And I don't know. I was feeling myself.
I actually, Tommy, would agree. I was doing some TV at Wimbledon that year. I legitimately thought that you had a shot to win Wimbledon as well. Last year in the quarters against Alcaraz, because like you mentioned, you had beaten him before. You'd beaten him in Montreal. You'd beaten him some big hard court matches before, and you've always played him very tough. But his level that day, like that was the point where watching him play you, and as he started to take control in that match, that was when I was in my head was like, okay, he's going to win the tournament because this level is just absurd. Yeah. And he got stronger as the tournament went on.
Yeah, I mean, even just that match, like we played. The first set in that match was insane. I think it was an hour and a half long, the first set. And I mean, I played just about as good as I could play. And, you know, I was hoping that maybe he would drop his level a little bit after the first. And that did not happen at all. He picked up his level and my level dropped and his did not come down. I mean, you know how good these guys are at like front running. Once they get a lead, they do not stop for anything. So that level was scary.
Is there a difference mentally for you taking a loss like against Novak in Australia where you maybe don't think you are, you know, at that level compared to taking a loss to Alcaraz at Wimbledon in the quarters when you think you are playing really good tennis?
The one in Australia, I was pretty like happy. Obviously, I wanted to win that match, but I was pretty happy to be in the semis. You know, it was my first semifinals of the slam. I wasn't by any means like super pissed when I walked off the court. I was just like, wow, like I just got my ass whooped on center court semifinals of a slam, you know? And then at Wimbledon, I kind of came off the court with a different kind of idea in my head. I was kind of like, all right, like this guy's playing at a different speed than me. Like we have to go to the practice court and we got to like work on ball speed. We got to work on, I mean, I kind of just took stuff that he was doing in the match and took it to the practice court. And I think it's a good thing, but it's also Alcaraz does things that I don't think any of us can do at the same time. So I have to do it in my own way.
Tennis for you, how much is like a passion versus does it feel like a job these days? So I feel like at some point that kind of happens to a lot of people that play.
You know, when you're traveling, it feels like a job when you're doing the same thing over and over and over on the road. The days look exactly the same. That's when it feels like a job. But then when I play my matches, it feels like my passion. I love competing. And I love training. I love basically all of it besides the travel and, you know, some of the hotels and shitty food that we eat.
Moving on to like off court, I got two questions. One, do you think tennis is like cooler now than it was 5 years ago? We saw all the celebrities and stuff at the US Open. And then two, who's more famous outside of a tennis court, you or your girlfriend, Paige? It's like, honestly, at the tennis tournament, I went to watch you play your first round match at the US Open this year, Monday night. As she was walking down to the court, I bet she got stopped like 25 times for photos.
Yeah, well, she's taking
like
them.
20% of the, she's taking them, all only dudes.
Yeah, I've been telling her, you can't be doing that.
So is tennis cooler now than it was 5 years ago? And yeah, who, if you're out and about in the city, like who's getting recognized more?
Oh, in the city, her for sure. Like in New York City? Like in the States?
Yeah, any city. Yeah. Just the city.
Well, I mean, in the States, her for sure. But if we're in like Rome, probably me, you know? Like there's more tennis fans in Europe than, I guess, blonde influencer followers.
And then do you think tennis is cooler now than it was 5 years ago? I don't remember all those celebrities at the U.S. Open back in the day, and now it's like a rock concert.
I don't know. I feel like tennis has had its like waves, you know, it goes up and down. And right now it's at an up, but you know, maybe it'll drop in 5 years or 10 years, but the sport is healthy right now, I think.
So basically what you're saying is when each one of us were the number one ranked American.
This is why at a certain time
it wasn't that cool.
This is why we didn't move the needle. Like that, because simple. I knew that was coming.
We're lame. He's calling us lame.
I'm happy to say that you guys are a lot cooler than I ever was as the number one or two ranked American stuff.
Like this generation of guys are studs.
We're old and lame. That's what we are.
We should do a poll. Who's cooler? Like Paul, Fritz, TFO, Opelka, or the four
of
us?
Leave my name out of that.
Coolness.
I don't want to be associated.
You're cool, dude. Dude, you came on the pod this morning, the new haircut and shaven beard.
Maybe me and my guys will just start a pod and we'll just like rival your guys' pod. See who gets more views.
No, bring it. I want to see it. We open that.
You don't want that.
No, I don't.
They don't have the consistency to go week in, week out like we're doing.
No, we don't.
No.
Francis would never show up
to our craft.
All right. Thanks to Tommy for that interview. We're going to have part two of that interview next week. Today's part was kind of the meat and potatoes of it. Next week is going to be more kind of rapid fire questions. So we're going to put Tommy on the hot seat. Tune in next week for part two of the Tommy Paul interview. All right, let's move on to this. This post kind of was going around Instagram, the internet, about a week ago. Tennis players get the smallest cut of total revenue in major sports. So I've got the list here. Premier League, the players are getting, and this is total revenue, what percentage the players get for their salaries. Premier League, 61%. Bundesliga, 53%. NBA, NHL, NFL, MLB, all about 50%. Then you've got the AFL, PGA in the 20%. And then ATP tennis is 17% of total revenue is going to the players. All right, so seeing these numbers, tennis of the major sports around the world, kind of one of the lowest as far as revenue share for players. And the three of us, we don't know the ins and outs. We don't have the financials in front of us. We don't know what it takes to run a big tournament. But Stevie, what are your initial thoughts on the players, tennis players, receiving 17% of revenue share and kind of being, of all the major sports around the world, kind of the lowest of the sports in terms of revenue share?
It's a bit tricky to compare them to the NFL, NBA, MLB, like the big sports leagues, because they all have one league, right? Like it's 30 teams, 32 teams, whatever it is. And tennis is very segmented, where the slams are their own world. And then you go to the ATP world, where we have the thousands, 500s, and 250s, where we all kind of know the structure there, where the pay is better at the thousands and so on and so forth. And then, you know, from a financial standpoint, you know, tennis, you know, the thousands risk almost the least amount of sweat equity and capital, and they gain the most. Whereas the 250 tournaments, the Delray Beaches, the, you know, Atlantas back in the day, whatever it may be, they risk the most to make the least amount of money because they don't know what their player field is going to be. The thousand, the Master Series have, it's mandatory. Carlos, Sinner, Medvedev, Alcaraz, you name it, have to play Indian Wells, or they take a zero, or they lose a fine, something of that nature. But these tournaments in Marseille this week, for example, they need to pay Medvedev to come there. So they are basically, you know, betting on him to bring in sponsorship dollars, to bring in ticket sales. And if he doesn't do well, or he pulls out because he gets hurt, that's just bad luck for the tournament. So these smaller tournaments ultimately have to risk the most to get players there to then try and get some return on their investment through ticket sales, merchandise, alcohol, whatever it might be once they get through the gate at the door. So it's just a bit of a backwards environment in tennis, where the big tournaments risk almost the least to gain the most. I don't know if that's how you guys felt, but that's how I looked at it in the grand scheme of things. If Indian Wells doesn't have a lot to risk, like everyone's going to come, they're going to get hundreds of thousands of people through the door. And then conversely, back in the day for us, like Sam and I playing the LA Open, it's tricky because you need to get big names, and it's tougher to get people through the door without being such a big event.
No, absolutely. And these smaller events, a lot of them don't have permanent stadiums and structures. So a lot of their revenue and expenses are to build this stadium every year, where, you know, a lot of the Masters Series have permanent structures. They don't have that cost every year, but you're right. It is very difficult for the lower level tournaments. John, like you and I were on the player council for a long time. We're always trying to get ATP revenue up.
Yeah. I mean, I think Stevie brought up a good point about the thousands. They're in obviously a fantastic position. There's no appearance fees. It's mandatory weeks. They have the best media deals. Everything, you know, points in favor to those Masters 1000s events doing incredibly, incredibly well. Now, on the other tournament, I guess one thing you have to realize is that no tournament, like these tournament assets, no tournament has ever been sold for a loss. So these tournaments, their assets are always, you know, appreciating all the time. Now, year over year, they might not make as big a profit as they did last year, so on. But for the players, where I have an issue is that our assets, every time as a player, you go out there, you're depreciating your biggest asset, and that's your body and your health as you continue to get older and put miles on your body. So our assets, which is our bodies, as players, is constantly depreciating in a sense versus these tournaments. Their assets are constantly appreciating over time. As I said, no tournament has ever been sold for a loss, even at the 250 level. So tournaments, in my mind, obviously there's always going to be this power struggle between players and tournaments. And we're not always going to be happy, right? In neither side. But in my mind, the tournaments do sort of have the upper hand over the players. And a lot of times, tournaments can sort of cry poor, and that's really not the case. I mean, you see these numbers in the revenue share that the players are getting, and it's not up to par with the rest of the sports. If anything, you'd like it to get closer to what the PGA Tour is at, which is a bit above what the ATP Tour is at right now, but that's just not the case. So players have been talking about this for a long time. So this Instagram post that you mentioned, Sam, that got a lot of traction, I think was good for players in general, because it got a lot of, I guess, novice eyeballs on the topic that we've been talking about for so long.
Yeah. And you know, for John, I mean, hits the nail on the head, I think, with his last kind of point there was these tournaments they're not selling for less. Same in all the other sports. I mean, we hear the same thing in basketball and football where these, you know, where the owners of the team, like, oh, you know, we're at a loss this year. We lost, you know, $200 million or whatever because we have to play the payer salaries, et cetera, and so on and so forth. And then they sell the team for $7 billion, right? Like, it's an investment in the long term. The tournaments, I feel as if the tournaments, let's just use one in the States, for example. I think Houston for us, the 250, it's a small event. They don't worry about bottom line as much, and they worry about players, enjoyment players, you know, getting them there and the facilities. And therefore, that tournament, I think, ultimately makes the most because they make an investment in the tournament and in the players. So the tournaments that I feel like kind of nickel and dime you are the ones that players don't generally want to go back to year over year.
Yeah, and these other sports have collective bargaining. A lot of them have players' unions. There's revenue shares in these leagues. Until we get to that point or that moment in tennis, things will most likely kind of continue on as they are. You know, and tennis is a little different because it's a worldwide league. You know, most of these other leagues, you're just playing in America or just playing in Europe. It's easier to have those unions and things like that. But you guys crushed it. These tournaments are like houses. You buy it for X, no matter what happens, it just the value for the most part, or in tennis's case, is always going up. And so they're worth so much. So well said, John. I think you have one more point to add.
I just think when it comes to tournament finances, the players feel like, and rightly so, that there's always been this sort of inherent lack of transparency with tournament finances at all levels across the ATP Tour. So the players feel like they're getting the raw end of the deal because we haven't gotten, in a lot of tournaments, we haven't gotten the true financials of these tournaments. So it's hard to, you know, so we're lacking the knowledge to go after the prize money that we want because we just don't know the financials and we can't get a true answer of them.
Yeah, and a lot of these, especially the Masters Series and the Slams, you'll go to the event, and to their credit, they might be building another stadium or building a new player area that costs $50 million. And it's great for the players, but that's also a massive chunk of change that could go into the prize money. So the tournaments, if they might generate $100 million, I'm throwing numbers out of thin air, but they spend $60 million on another massive stadium court, they're saying, no, we only brought in $40 million this year. Well, no, you brought in 100, but you spent 60 of it to make your tournament better, which is nice. But what about one of the years that extra money goes into the prize money and maybe not, you know, upgrade your facility?
Exactly.
And I think at the ATP, at the 1000 level, you see what they're doing, making these 1000 so long. They're adding more days to these tournaments, which I also think completely tunes the fans out.
Yeah, whatever. Slams as well. Slams are all starting on Sundays now.
US Open just did it. US Open just did it on adding a 15th day, the first Sunday. So they're bringing in more days, which creates more revenue, and that's not being shared appropriately with the players. And a lot of some tournaments are getting squeezed because of these extended Masters 1000s events. Now they have these super challenger events instead of a few 250s. So I think players ranked 10 to 30 are getting hurt because typically they could get appearance fees at a 250 event to make money that way after a 1000 or before a 1000. Because these tournaments are so long now, there's that revenue stream that they had, you know, years prior that they don't have now. Now they add these super challenger events and they make you sort of have to play them, let's say between Madrid and Rome, because both tournaments are so long. If you lose early in Madrid, you're like, I don't want to wait 12 days till my next match. I'll go play this super challenger event. You're not getting paid to play it. Yes, there's decent points on the line, but again, you're putting your body out there on the line. And, you know, your biggest asset, as I said, is depreciating playing a challenger event before a big 1000 like Rome would be.
No, it's well said. Hopefully all the owners of the Masters Series and Slams are listening to this podcast. We're on to you guys. But yeah, hopefully, look, I hope we do this podcast again in a year and that 17% number, honestly, if it goes to 18, great. But we want that to keep creeping up. I think John said it best. If they can get to, I think the PGA was at 22%. That seems like a goal that could be attainable for the tennis world. But anyway, we'll see what happens with that. All right, guys, that's it for this episode. Make sure everyone keep following us on social at Nothing Major Show. We're on YouTube, TikTok, X, Instagram. Audio shows come out on Friday. YouTube comes out on Monday. All right, we got trivia this week. Which non-pod player did we face collectively the most? So the four of us, which player, not one of the four of us, collectively did we play the most on tour? I think I know it. I think John thinks he knows it. Should we give Stevie the first crack at the guess?
I'm going to go with Adrian Mannarino.
Definitely not.
No, it wasn't going to be my guess. I think it was a good guess. Sam, what is the answer?
It's got to be Kevin Anderson.
It's Kevin Anderson. 46!
46 times. Oh my God. That's got to be like by far the most.
Yeah, that's a miss on my behalf. I forgot about the big dog.
I mean, just Isner and I alone.
9-4 against him. That doesn't even count college. I was like 3-0 against him in college. Well, but yeah, he beat me in the Wimbledon semifinals. I'd rather be 4-9 with a Wimbledon semifinal win.
I was just going to ask, would you take back all 9 wins for a Wimbledon final?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's a stupid question. All right, good trivia.
God, Stevie was sneaky good against big, not sneaky good, just good against big servers.
Yeah, I was really good against big servers because I could grease out gross points and I could hold against you losers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Your cat and mouse game was pretty good with stuff.
Yeah, I was pretty good at that.
Yep.
Sneaky good.
That was good. That was smooth.
We missed Jack this week. He'll be back next week and we'll see you guys then.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.